Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's March 15, 2015, and welcome to episode 96 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and collecting. Hi, I'm your host, Michael Mulhern, and I'm calling in from lovely, cool New South Wales here in Australia. The heat seems to have gone, and we're starting to enjoy autumn, and I'm looking forward to the cool weather. Joining us from the sunny northern climes of Sweden is Jack. How are you this morning, Jack?
I'm doing pretty good. It's actually getting sunny here. Of course, we're heading the opposite of you. We're heading towards the warmer parts of the year, but it's still like below freezing most of the time. But at least we're having some nice blue skies and sunshine, which is good.
It actually got down to 14 degrees last night, so it was good, very good. In another cooler part of the world, in lovely downtown Boston, is Paul. How are you today, Paul?
I'm doing pretty well. Things are actually, you know, looking a little bit more like spring. So that's always good.
Well, that's good. I'm only too happy to send our summer north for you to start enjoying. Okay. Well, I suppose we can just gather around the informal coffee table again today. There's not many of us, but I was just thinking, basically because of some work that I've been doing, that it's 30 years ago that HP and Apple released their first laser printers, both of them based on a small Canon engine. And I was just wondering, guys, when did you first use a laser printer instead of an impact or thermal printer?
Good question. I think that when I was in high school, the school had some laser printers that normally students didn't have any way to use. I mean, they barely had computers we could use for anything. But like, there were, if you were taking the right sort of classes, like if you're involved in the student newspaper or things like this, there were some laser printers. And I remember that the people would, I think I never had any access to this, but that some people somehow did. And like those people who had like the keys to the kingdom, like they could produce these things that were so much nicer than anybody else could do. But I think the first time I really used any laser printers at all was, must have been 1989 when I went to college. And there was both the Apple printers of various kinds, and then also the Next printers, which were also the Canon engine things. So before that, I think all I had was at home. I had a variety of, I think I'd had a few different dot matrix printers, and I had one tiny plotter, which was also cool in its way, but it was nothing you could print anything big on. How about you, Paul?
That pretty much echoes, you know, what my experience with it. I think I saw those Next printers. I don't think I actually used them. And I'm pretty sure the first time I had real access to a laser printer was the computer lab in college. So, and I didn't have my own for a long time, and they were so slow. I mean, you know, the kind of low-end ones that you could get, whatever, 300 DPI and you know, a page every 2 hours. Well, but Michael, what you?
Well, I'd say I was pretty much there when it first happened. I didn't actually see the first HP laser jets, but I definitely saw the first of the Apple laser writers come in to. At that stage, I'd left computers and peripherals, and I was working at an insurance company. And when I went back to computers and peripherals, actually it was to buy a 3.5-inch SuperDrive for my 2C. And they took me out the back to show me the newly arrived Apple laser printer. And over here in Australia, it was about $10,000 worth. I think it was about $7,000 US. So not too bad a price difference. And they were just setting it up, and it just blew me away. It was, I'd obviously read about laser printers, and you just weren't quite ready for the jump in quality, even from daisy wheel impact printers and the so-called near letter quality ones. But when you first saw a page come out of a laser printer, it was just a totally different world. And then I was basically a working, as I said, in an insurance company. I was doing the policy variations, so I was doing a lot of the light actuarial work for policy changes. And then a job came up in the IT section in the branch, and I really wanted to get back into programming, so I followed that up and was involved in the nationwide project of rolling out IBM 3820 production laser printers. Now, I suppose the easiest way would be to say that I'll go back to our refrigerator unit of measurement. So it was about, I'd say, three refrigerators lying down horizontally in mass and almost and just a little bit underneath that size. So it was quite a large beast, 20 pages per minute. It was only 240 DPI, not the 300, and it was using IBM's AFP, Advanced Function Printing, rather than PostScript. And that was just phenomenal. And 20 pages per minute, it certainly left the smaller desktop lasers that were coming out behind. That was truly production speed, if you would know, gone from minutes per page to 20 pages per minute. And I've been in laser printers ever since. So seeing the evolution of the smaller desktop laser printers through to today, where they're a commodity device. They're really just a toner consumption unit. Now, the toner replacement for some of the base end models these days costs more than the laser printer itself. The color ones are almost at that stage where anyone could literally go down to their local computer supplier, office supply company, and come home with a color laser printer. Everything's that cheap on them these days. But work-wise, I'm actually seeing the, for me anyway, the end of laser printing. I've moved from large, hundreds of impressions per minute. Some printers I've seen are in the over 1,000 impressions per minute. And a lot of the printing these days is effectively being done on large inkjet printers. So but another shift in the printing world. So full color laser, I think, almost made it there. I think the era of the laser printer could be coming to an end. But then again, they've been predicting the end of mainframes for about the last 20 years. So I'm not going to rush to say that they're dead. But they've been fun. So how was your first experience with using, say, a page layout program? Did you suffer from ransom noteitis, or were you just trying to fit as many fonts onto the page as possible, if only because they were there in the laser printer itself?
I think I remember that I was mostly, the first time that I had access to a laser printer and was using it a lot was in college, and that was the Next printers. And they were interesting because I think unlike the Apple laser writers and stuff, I think the Next printers, they were pretty dumb. Like, it was pretty much just kind of a serial connection to the Next itself. And all of the PostScript rendering was done on the Next, and it was passed over, which made them a little bit cheaper than the corresponding Apple printers were.
Okay, because the Apple printers had basically were a computer, a remote computer, which then interpreted the PostScript and emitted it to the drum.
Right, and so I think that since Next already had the PostScript engine for the display, they used the same software just to render to a different resolution and send it to the printer.
Printers
were a bit cheap. Yeah, it made sense, and it worked fine. So I remember that there were various programs on the Next that I would play with to make. Paul, you remember I made band posters and stuff, and for the shows we would do.
Yeah, just that's exactly what I was thinking, yeah.
And, like, other, just, like, printing out weird stuff just because, the novelty of having this thing that could, you know, you could print anything and it would look pretty nice. And I remember doing, there was an old app on the Next called Create, which made by Stone Design Software. I wouldn't be surprised that it still exists for Mac OS X these days. And with that, you could do things like you could make weird vector art stuff, and then you could sort of blow it up. I remember blowing things up to print across 9 pages or 16 pages, and then like cutting off the edges and trying to tape it together to make a big thing. Just like crazy stuff. I didn't really use it for anything appropriate, I would say. It was all just sort of like just goofing around with this thing. Because I was, you know, I was 19 or whatever. I didn't have any sort of reason to print anything for real. It was just like playing with this thing for, you know, for fun. And it was so much more fun doing that than, you know, compared to the dot matrix printers that I had access to before. Because suddenly you had this thing that would just like produce this nice, crisp document, and it was pretty sweet. And interestingly, as I'm thinking with this, I've actually still never had a laser printer at home all this time. I have an inkjet right now that I've had for probably 4 or 5 years, and it's still working. And, you know, I guess I don't print enough to really sort of think about it that much. Maybe if, when this one goes, when this one dies, the next printer might be a laser printer. We'll see. Because like you said, Michael, they're getting so cheap. It's just like not even.
Yeah,
it's just kind of ridiculous.
It's almost got to the stage. If it, just for a mono laser printer, the toner's run out. I think I'll go buy a new printer.
One of my colleagues recently, he said that he went to go pick up a printer. He needed to have just a black and white printer at home, just a monochrome printer. And he went to the store and said, "What is the, you know, the cheapest, like what is the low end worst printer you have?" And it's like, "Oh, it's this laser printer, and it's got Wi-Fi, and it's got this and this and this and this, and it costs, you know, $100 or whatever, maybe not even that."
No, I've seen them for less than $100. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's so as far as, you know, getting back into the vintage stuff, I have a couple of old printers. One that I do have is that Next laser printer, just because it looks nice, you know, it looks like a Next. I have not yet attempted to sort of use it, and I'm not actually sure. I maybe have like 4 or 5 printers of various sorts. Well, maybe even more than that. But of course, when you're in this sort of vintage hobby, vintage computing hobby, it's not so clear, you know, how much I'm going to really ever want to print. You know, I suppose I can print greeting cards with you know, whatever that is, print shop or banners or something. But with specifically with the Next laser printer, I'm wondering, and I don't, you know, I haven't explored this, and maybe you haven't either, but I am kind of wondering, if I want to make it work, can I get toner? You know, if I need to replace a piece, is it anything like the current pieces? I don't really know how much things have advanced technologically.
As far as toner goes, I picked up a Apple, let me just check it. It's a 16600, and it uses the HP2 toner cartridge a lot, which, of course, it's all, again, based on a Canon engine. So you can actually buy, for a lot of the older vintage laser printers, you can actually still get toner cartridges new, not remanufactured refills. So that's pretty good that way. But, yeah, I've only got that laser printer because I was buying an older Duo, I think a 230, back when I was collecting Mac Apple laptops. And they had that one there, and he said, "Oh, do you want to take that as well?" And I said, "Yeah, why not?"
So it wasn't
being
shipped.
I hadn't driven in. No, it was up the road from where I was working in the Sydney CBD, and got carried away, and then basically had to lift this. Fortunately, it was in original packing, so massive, great, heavy printer, carrying it to the railway station, getting up onto the platform, then sort of getting it home. So I've made sure I left work early so I wasn't on a peak hour train, because I didn't feel like hopping on with a couple of hundred other people into a carriage and sort of like jostling for position, carrying must have been at least 30 kilos of printer as well as my normal stuff in my backpack. But the only other printers that I've got is my original ImageWriter 1, which came with my 2C, and last hooked it up with was to a 512K Mac, and then the other printer is just an Epson stylus of some variety that can, back in when I wanted to print on DVDs and CDs when I was doing the family video and things, so I'd produce the DVD and then just do some cover art for the folder and print on the disc, but never really got into laser printing at home. I suppose it's because I've always had bigger and faster things to work with during office hours, so never really needed to have a laser printer at home. But back to the origin of them. So notes I've got here, LaserJet was $3,500, and the LaserWriter from Apple, when introduced, was $7,000. And Jobs was asked, why should someone spend twice as much on Apple's laser printer? They quote, he went ballistic, because HP is brain dead, he exclaimed. So John Warnock was the other presenter there. People might know him as worked for a little company called Adobe. And he was a little bit more diplomatic, and he went on to explain PostScript and how the LaserWriter basically took that, interpreted it all, laid it down onto the paper. And the other interesting thing is that it's actually said that the LaserWriter actually was costing Apple $7,000 to get to the shop. So unlike a lot of Apple equipment, which has reputedly a large margin, they were selling this one without much of a margin. And Jobs basically said one of the reasons for the cost was the price of the RAM that they were using. And he could see that RAM prices were going to decrease, as were going to be some of the other component costs, and that would be where their margin would be coming from. So he saw that being able to connect it via Apple Talk and have multiple users using it, that could get it into companies. So it's interesting, because this actually shows that it was a conscious decision to attack the business market rather than the home market. Because not many people would have been in a position to spend $7,000 US on a laser printer. But the fact that you could actually network it and use it. So, you know, Apple have played with getting into the business market and out of the business market for ever since they've been in business, I suppose. So it's just interesting reading the approach that they took to getting the LaserWriter out there into the market. But as I said, walked out the back of Computer Peripherals and saw them getting it all set up to use. And I suppose I've been playing with laser printers ever since. So
I do remember that there was, in this sort of intermediate era, there was a time when it was quite confusing to try to deal with, you know, whether the difference, I forget what it is, APL. There's some sort of like alternative printing language that some printers did PostScript, some printers did this other thing, you know, so you had to get converters to go between them if you got the cheap printer that only did was it APL? I don't know.
That was more the programming language, but
what is it called?
Yeah, didn't HP have some?
Well, HP had PCL.
PCL,
page control language. Not really something that you could switch between the two.
Apple
basically went down their Apple Talk path, and the PCL printers, they basically were predominantly from the HP, and the people who were following off from HP, they had the parallel port connections. I've been playing with laser printers, desktop and production for, I suppose, 30 years now. So now, I didn't have computers or printers at school, so I missed out on all that fun that you young guys seem to play with. But, I finished high school when I was, 16? So that was 81. Yep, so I finished up in 80. What was it, 80? I think I finished in 1980. That was my last year at high school.
Okay, a bit ahead of us.
That's interesting. I know when I graduated, because I was in the class of X, you know.
In Australia, we don't really do that graduation thing from high school. That's more something from university. But I've noticed that these days there is more about that. People you work with, they're going, "Oh, my kid's graduating," and "Oh, so they, what were they doing at university?" "Oh no, high school," and it's just sort of like it's something that's sort of like coming in now. The one that really irks me is when one happy, proud parent said that they were attending their child's graduation. They were moving from kindergarten to year one. So
yeah.
I think that's going a little bit too far, but I think that's a little bit off topic. So,
although I will add one quick thing, just, complete tangent now.
Why not?
There's a radio show in the U.S. called Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, which is a kind of a, it's like a quick comedy quiz show. It's kind of, but, so some years ago they had our current president on as a guest and we're talking to him. He was at the time, I think, a senator, and there's actually a fairly large bit in there where he kind of rails against the kindergarten graduation. it's pretty good to listen to, and it's pretty easy to find, I think, and there'll be a link perhaps if it's a, anyway, whatever. It reminded me of that.
Proud parents, sometimes they're so funny.
It can go too far.
Yeah. Well, I think that wraps up laser printers for now. So, Paul, how were we in the listener feedback department since the last show?
We did get a few emails, although I think we're going to save most of them for future shows. But one of the things that I noticed was, so last time we had been talking a bit about, how to prepare for the time when we no longer sort of have stewardship of our collection for one reason or another.
Say it, when we're pushing up the daisies.
Yep, exactly. when we are, ex-collectors. But at any rate, so there were some suggestions about like keeping an inventory or actually sticking a little note or writing with a grease pen or something on the things themselves. Brent wrote in suggesting that actually one good thing to do now that it's actually easy to do is a kind of a video tour. So, actually walking through the collection with video, that'll be, for one thing, it'll be, something the people left behind might want to watch. And also, it's much better than just trying to describe what the thing is or even, show the picture or whatever. So I thought that was a good sort of thing to add in there now that we're in a technological era where it's easy.
Yeah, it's a lot more quick and easy to do. Just point it, talk. Everyone's got video camera of some flavor on their smartphone or even standalone camcorders. Nice, small and compact, perfect for that. And it'd be easy just to, as you said, just point it at each of the items, give a little bit of a commentary if you wanted to get fancy, even get yourself into the shop. Definitely a good suggestion for a video tour of what you've got. Might even be handy while you're still here, just to remind you of what's there and what goes with what, so you can go looking for it. Been a few times where I would have liked to even just a inventory or a video to refer back to, so as not to buy the same thing twice.
Oh, I've done that. So I have.
But maybe that's just a different problem.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It's
This may be actually taking it a bit too far, but one idea might be to invite one of these TV shows that helps hoarders deal with their stash. They can come do the video for you.
I don't think I'd like how it would turn out.
No. I think I'll be locking the gates. No, not letting those kind of people near my stuff. They just don't understand.
I need this thing. This cable is important.
Yes, I might need it in 10, 20 years. It might be worth something. Yeah. Okay, so we also had a few pieces of listener feedback for news items that we've got in here that we had already selected. So it's good to see that our listeners are looking out for us and also on the same wavelength when it comes to items of interest. So speaking of items of interest, Jack, at a recent GDC, what happened?
Well, some fun stuff at the latest GDC, which is the Game Developer Conference. They usually have a variety of postmortems of people who come in and talk about some game projects that they were working on. Sometimes they have some old ones or some classic games. A few years ago, they had one by David Crane, who talked about developing Pitfall for the Atari 2600. This year, they actually had two guys talking about their classic 2600 games. Warren Robinette, who did Adventure, and Howard Scott Warshaw, who made Yar's Revenge. Warshaw went on to make also the E.T. game, which is widely disliked by many people. But what he was talking about this year was Yara's Revenge, which is very interesting. It has the story is that Atari wanted to do a port of the game Star Castle, which was an arcade game with vector graphics that was just graphically completely impossible to do on the Atari 2600. And so Warshaw sort of pushed back and said, I can't do that, but I can do this other thing that takes some of these concepts and gives it a bit of a twist and some new play, and became Yara's Revenge, which became one of the most popular games for the platform. The previous one that I mentioned, Warren Robinette, he did this Adventure. And Adventure, if you look at it today, of course, through our eyes, everyone knows this looks like. It's very blocky. Your character is a block. You're going through this blocky maze. You fight a dragon that looks like a duck. And but despite that, it actually had a lot of breakthroughs, not so much technologically, somewhat that, but also just sort of conceptually. Because before this, most video games were sort of single screen affairs. Like you were some sort of ship or character moving around on a screen, one screen at a time, and that was sort of it. Maybe there was some scrolling involved, but typically, you know, think about games like Space Invaders or Pac-Man or whatever, there's kind of a screen going on. Whereas Adventure was one of the first games, perhaps the first game, that had this notion of you move your character across a screen, it goes off the left side and comes in on the right side on a new screen. This idea of the world being bigger than the screen that you're on. So there were some breakthrough new concepts there. And of course, he managed to squeeze it all into this tiny cartridge, which is, you know, looking at today is pretty amazing. And actually, he has a new book. Robinette's working on an ebook called The Annotated Adventure, where he's taken his adventure source code and actually ported it to C to make it more readable and understandable for more readers today. So anyway, both of these videos I'm looking forward to seeing. They're not actually up yet. They will be on the GDC website at some point within the next few weeks, probably.
Both of those sound quite interesting. So, Paul, you spotted one which had me interested as well. So there's a Kickstarter project out there amongst many.
Yeah, so this is actually, if you're listening to this, you know, sort of very shortly after we recorded it, you must have seen this because it's been going around everywhere. But so there was a Kickstarter by some people who came across the original molds, the metal molds used to make the Commodore 64C computer. So these were the things that actually, you know, the plastic was formed within. And they're the original ones. They were the actual production molds for the computer. And so they're starting a Kickstarter to make new Commodore 64C computer housings pressed from the original molds. And so right now, it's blown way past its goal. It's going to happen. They were looking for a $10,000 goal, and it's already at $62,000. So if you want to back it, you can get, you know, sort of reserve one of these molds for yourself. I think it's really pretty cool that these are in a sense authentic. You know, they're not exactly reproductions because they're being made in exactly the same way that the originals were. I think there's some risk. They have pictures. So they come in all, you can have them in all sorts of colors, including clear.
Yeah, I was just about to say, I do like that clear one. It makes me almost want to go out and get hold of a spare C64 just to put in a clear case.
Yeah,
I'm thinking the exact same thing. I don't even want a Commodore 64, but I kind of do now.
Because of that clear
case. Yeah. So I see in the pictures blue, white, and red, sort of beige, and then clear. And yeah, it does sort of seem like clear is the one that would be the one that's sort of most striking. And there are a lot of pictures of the clear case, actually. Take a look at it, and I still haven't decided myself whether I'm going to try for it, but it looks like they're only $35.
Well, $35 shipping, that's actually quite reasonable even for either the red, white, or blue one. Don't know about the beige, it's just... I've had enough old computer beige sitting in front of enough of it right now, so I don't think I need any more. Though I must admit, some of this computer beige does have that yellowy tinge to it as well. So
yeah, it's really cool that they managed to get the molds for this. we need if more computer molds and things like this were discovered, just because it's true, all of the existing ones are all quite yellow. If we had the mold, we could just make more. But yep. Anyway, so that yep. that's this. Everybody's been talking about it, so.
And why shouldn't we? Okay, so Jack, you've got a little bit more here from GDC, some ancient Atari goodness. So what did you see in the UK Business Insider website?
Well, there's some pretty interesting stuff. Whenever I see these articles, it makes me wonder why I don't go to GDC, because there's always seems to be so much interesting stuff happening there. So one of the things that they had this time, courtesy of the, the Video Game History Museum, they had an exhibit of old Atari stuff, including things like crazy merch, swag, in the form of frisbees and t-shirts and buttons and pins and all sorts of things. And also they had some rare and unusual games and prototypes and pieces of hardware. There were some interesting variants on the Atari 2600. And it seemed to have a lot of devices that were set up that you could actually play. So they had some things that were pretty common, some things that are a bit more rare. And just it was nice that they seemed to have had sort of a display that was not only, you know, it's not like you think of a museum as things being sort of in a display case, but this stuff was actually out and right there. So, also, there's a lot of cool stuff there. Besides the link that we're posting, there are actually plenty of other links that show pictures of even more stuff. This was also covered in a lot of places. So, worth checking out if you're interested in old Atari stuff.
Yeah, I do like seeing the machines out from behind glass. Doesn't necessarily have to be hands-on, but and operational, but which is the best. But I do like how they got the static displays here, so that you can actually sort of get up close to them, and they do seem to be hands-on and running. So
it's pretty interesting to see. The depth of my knowledge of Apple history is much deeper than of Atari history, and so I see a lot of these things that I've never heard of before. That seems pretty cool. They have Halloween costumes.
Like the Asteroids Halloween mask is pretty awesome looking.
Yeah, and this Atari graduate, which apparently you slap on the top of your 2600 and then you have a keyboard. I don't know what you... Of course, the 2600 doesn't really have any RAM, right? What does it have, like 128
right.
bytes?
Yeah, so I think that was actually never really produced. I think that was a prototype. And at some point, they realized, we could do this, but you can't really do anything with it. So it would have been extremely limited. So I think that did not become an actual product, I believe.
I'm not too familiar with the ET, but it looks to me like, yeah, that's got to be it. They have a display of a row of the gaming consoles. And, you know, one of the pictures you can see most clearly is ET sitting in the bottom of a pit.
Yep. Which is one of the classic infuriating moments of that game. You always end up falling into a pit.
Right, and stay there for a very long time.
And then get covered over and then become the subject of an excavation video. The circle of life.
Yep.
Yeah, cool. Anyway, I'll have to look at that more closely, but it's neat that they have the display.
Okay. Well, continuing on with rebirth and rediscovery, BBC Microbit. So this is a new BBC project. It's in itself is not per se retro computing, but it's basically a device which is going to be distributed free to every child in year 7 across the UK. So they're saying about a million devices in total will be distributed. So basically they're trying to get a small, easy-to-use computing, programming, scripting device, whatever you want to call it, into the hands of kids that they can basically do various things with. Just plug it in and use it. So that's another one of these news items that's been going around the various feeds that are out there. But what I thought was interesting is someone took it along to the National Museum of Computing at Bletchley Park, and is standing beside it, and they're the Colossus, and they're holding on to one of these eight BBC micro bits, and over their shoulder is Colossus. So we have, you know, basically a lovely juxtaposition of ye olde computing with not so ye olde. And I think that I just love the way he's holding on to it. Just thumb and forefinger, barely managing to hold on to the micro bit. And over in the background is Colossus. And actually, it's not all in shot. There's more of Colossus than that could fit into the photo. But yeah, it's just interesting, I find. So on again from one of the topics from the last episode of getting kids programming. So this is just another approach on that, to get a computing device matched in with the curriculum for the year, so that it can actually be used in class for various projects. I just think it's amazing. And just to remind people of the last time the BBC got involved in computers, I'll also include a link to the original BBC Micro.
This thing looks very small.
I'm trying to think. It makes a Raspberry Pi look big.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess in a sense, if you're just trying to get kids to, you know, play around and work on such a thing, I just wonder. It looks like a little exposed circuit board. But it's too small. Like, you have to have pretty fine motor control to actually do anything with it, I would imagine.
Well, it looks like it has some connectors that are these sort of metal rings that are probably easy to attach things to. So you're going to make sort of peripherals to wire this up somehow. That those are the things you can either use as a socket and stick something through it, or wrap a wire around it or something. It's like it's meant to be sort of...
Yeah, IC or alligator clip. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I guess the other thing I'd worry about is just, you know, eating or losing it. Well, we'll see how it goes.
Yeah.
So when are these supposed to be delivered?
Distributed nationwide from autumn 2015. So that would be autumn in the UK. So
right.
Second half of the year.
Cool.
So let's see, moving on. So I remember this one. Paul, talk to us about Al Lowe and his trials and tribulations at Sierra.
Okay. Well, so there's a website called Don't Die.
They don't die.
Yeah. Which it's supposed to be basically a collection of video game confessionals, and, you know, so talking interviews with video game creators or former players, and the idea is just sort of to get into deep ideas and so forth. And so recently. Quite recently, Al Lowe, who was the creator of Leisure Suit Larry for Sierra and a bunch of other things, who worked with them, did an interview, which was pretty interesting. It's worth reading, you know, just because Sierra.
It's a great read, this one. So
yeah, I mean, Sierra had a huge impact on the, you know, on the video game field, and I think he says in here somewhere that, you know, at some point 40%. Was it? I don't know. There was some fairly large percentage of the entire entertainment software market that they had. And so he talks a little bit about how Sierra was kind of like taken over by, you know, another entity, and the original developers kind of disappeared. And then there were lawsuits and financial shenanigans. And it's, you know, it is kind of interesting to hear the, you know, sort of read the development of this. He was sort of recently involved in, I think, a Kickstarter to restart, you know, to redo Leisure Suit Larry. I'm not, I forgot exactly what the story was with that, but I imagine it got funded. Anyway, we'll have a link to it. It's, you know, it's interview format. It's pretty conversational, but interesting.
I normally find it difficult to read some of these interview format articles, but this one, it was great. I was reading it last night, and it is hilarious in places. I don't think the interviewer was quite prepared for what they got, but I'm glad it's there, and I can only recommend that people be very careful how they drink any hot beverage while they're reading this one.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so do we have anything else here that looks that looks like a good time to pause for a vintage computer commercial.
Well, Fred, our little company's moving up.
Ooh, yeah, Max. Bright young staff, new clients.
Fortune 500, here we come.
Well, on our way to the top, let's stop at Computerland. We need another computer.
The Apple Macintosh 2 is tops in speed, power, and expandability.
Hmm, but the Macintosh SE is versatile, too, and just as easy to learn and use.
Let's get both.
Computerland was easy on the old budget.
Even taught you to use it, Max.
So, welcome back. So, let's have a look at the host retro computing gift ideas, that segment where the host gives some very unsubtle hints of what would be a nice gift for themselves. So, what I'm looking at this time round is a recreation ZX Spectrum as a Bluetooth keyboard. So, what we have here is a humble Bluetooth keyboard, but done with the dead flesh rubber keyboard of the Sinclair ZX Spectrum and styled as a ZX Spectrum. Now, I think the £99 price that they're proposing is a little bit on the high side for a Bluetooth keyboard, but boy, does this fit the bill as far as a retro gift idea? So, guys, what do you think? Do you think you could sit down in front of your computer or home entertainment system and use this as your keyboard?
That's pretty cool. I think I don't actually have any experience with the computer as a computer. So I do kind of wonder if it was a pleasant keyboard to type on. But
it wasn't. Yeah. No, definitely not.
It just seemed like a little bit of a step back in that. You know, it looks cool, but I kind of wonder. The other thing, too, is with keyboards like this, there's always the concern that, like, can you type a left brace, you know, or a pipe?
Yeah, it seems pretty limited repertoire what you can actually write with this keyboard. I don't know.
Yeah, I think.
But
I
maybe they thought of something. There seem to be all sorts of, like, weird modifiers and things printed out on the keys and above and below them. And maybe some of those, I guess some of those are from the original and some might be some extra facilities for modern stuff.
Yeah, I having just a cursory glance at the keyboard, I think I'd have a bit of a problem doing any serious programming, modern day programming on it. Even something basic as Perl programming, I think I'd have troubles with some of the character set that's available. But nonetheless, I just think it just looks so spiffy.
It looks great. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, definitely in the gift department. I don't think I would shell out £99 for this one myself. But
and it has all the keys and like the one we were looking at before, the actual Sinclair one. Clive Sinclair somehow is behind the, is that not correct? The like some sort of reintroduction of a gaming console that's specifically,
yes.
Except it has five buttons or something.
It has four keys. yes, it's a somewhat limited key set, but we covered that one, I think, about four or five shows ago? But
I think we covered it on a couple of them. We just can't remember, you know, from one show to the next.
I'm getting old, I can't remember things. Okay, off to the wonderful world of eBay. So, Jack, an Atari trackball controller for parts.
Yeah, so I'm continuing along my sort of my pattern here of this episode. All I'm talking about is ancient Atari stuff.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Controller. No, there's nothing wrong with that, but I have kind of a one-track
ball.
Trackball thing. One-track ball.
Yeah, boom-tish.
Sorry. So this was a controller for the Atari 2600 and also for the 8-bit computers. And, of course, it also works, for that matter, on the Commodore 64 and the Amiga and the Atari ST. It works like a joystick controller does. Basically, it's got the same sort of left, right, up, down. But if you have software that knows how to interpret this in a smarter way, you can use it to control the cursor in a game like, say, Centipede or Missile Command.
I was going
to
say Missile Command.
Yep. So, and the owner of this device says that when he last plugged it in, it worked okay, but it seemed a little bit jumpy. I'm guessing that I've never opened up one of these devices, but I'm guessing that inside it's got a couple of rollers, just like an old rollerball mouse, and probably those rollers get gummed up with crap on them and stop working.
Need some serious degunging.
Yep. So probably it's a pretty straightforward matter to open this thing up and clean it out and get it working. The current price is set at $20. That's actually the buy it now price even. Oh crap. That's pretty good, I think. Even though it's not working, I would guess this thing is probably going to be pretty easy to make working pretty well. And for that price, I think it's actually pretty good. I don't see a lot of these for sale, and if I do, I see that they're usually a bit higher than this. So, like I say, it's sort of as is. And he says it's not working 100% great, so buyer beware. But
I've usually had pretty good luck with those. You know, can't test it, doesn't seem to be working. Kind of thing, you know, just because everything was so simple, then you really could just open it up, reconnect the wire, and clean off the roller.
There's photos of it, and there's photos of the back, and that definitely looks like it's held together by screws rather than inline clips. So, yeah, it shouldn't be too difficult to pull that apart. And as you said, it's probably needing a good degunging. I remember having to regularly stop using my ball mouse back in the day and flip the cover off and drop it out and then get the bent paper clip or something to flick the accumulated gunge off the roller, put the ball back in, and you were back into Excel as fast as you ever were.
Yeah, I don't really miss those days.
No,
actually. No.
Just because it's so frustrating to use the mouse when it's skipping like that.
As it goes across your desk going clunk, 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 clunk. No, optical's so much better. As soon as the optical mouse came out, I grabbed one. But this is quite a nice-looking trackball, and that's with track with the dash, as they did spell it. And, it looks in pretty good condition. He says there's a few scratches and whatnot, but I think, definitely a steal at $19.99.
Yeah, I was going to say, I have been watching these when they show up, just because I wouldn't mind having one, but this is as cheap as I've seen them.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'm just got a few quick items here. So in the vein of old computer pointers, the first one I've got is called the Witty Mouse. I don't think it comes with a built-in sense of humor or anything along those lines, but...
what a weird name.
And it's a very blocky three-button mouse. So if you're after a good old-fashioned non-ergonomic mouse, I'm sure that your hand would feel this one after using it for a while. Not too bad. $20 Australian plus postage.
So what is this connector I'm seeing in the picture?
Yeah,
it's just like a huge wide connector that I cannot figure out what that is.
That's the full-size serial port.
Okay, sure.
So if you've only got the smaller DB9, you'll need to get out an adapter. And it looks like it comes with a spare mouse ball as well. So there you are.
Yeah, it's in the box, so at least it has the manual. And it says it's compatible with the IBM, so presumably I guess you must need some kind of driver. I don't really remember how the mice originally connected.
Well, I remember the good old days of having to put a mouse.drive or mouse.exe into either the config.sys or autoexec.bat. I'm sure that there are generic mouse drivers out there that will have it working in DOS. And I suppose if you had a serial to USB adapter in your kit of bits, so you could even get it hooked up to a more current machine if you wanted to have a retro mousing experience. Okay, so continue along on bits of ancient kit. I also have the Sinclair QL toolkit, and I was originally suggesting this one for our esteemed colleague Carrington, because this one's still in the shrink wrap. It's just crying out, "Carrington, rip me open." But so we have here a QL toolkit from Sinclair. It's not something that I've used. But if you're after some programming kit for your Sinclairs, this is a little bit for you. So it's a QL Toolkit from 1985. New in box, still shrink-wrapped. 1995.
Yeah, that's a weird category of thing, actually. Because it is still shrink-wrapped.
Yeah.
But, you know, so basically it seems to be things to help you program natively on a Sinclair on a QL.
Yeah. I'm sure that there's disk images or equivalent available if you want to hook that up in through an emulator. But I do have a soft spot for original application programming software and extensions and toolkits along that line. Okay. Mm-hmm. And the last one I've got is not really retro as in age, but it's a deck of playing cards which has been custom printed with the Apple II, one of the iconic Apple IIc, I suppose, posters. So been reduced down to playing card size. This one has only got 2 and a bit days left, but it's currently 10 available. Buy it now, $6.99 Australian. So not quite sure. Has that got international delivery?
Yeah.
It says, yeah, it does.
How much is it to get it to your ends of the world?
To Sweden, it is $18 Australian.
Yeah, that's about what it cost me to send something off to the UK a little while ago, and probably a similar amount to the US. $7.45 delivery Australian, but I've ordered myself one of these, mainly because I do have a soft spot for the Apple IIc. It is my preferred 8-bit Apple. Never really hit it off with anything, the GS or anything later, such as the 2E Platinum. But I've got a soft spot for the old Apple IIc. So I thought I'd get the playing cards just for something different.
When I first saw these, I didn't realize that they weren't actual, Apple gift store or gift catalog item, but they are newly made.
Yeah, a little bit of IP infringement, I think, but I thought I'd grab mine before a cease and desist was issued, if such a thing would be. Same thing as a couple of years ago, there was a Chinese company making, they called them iHubs. They were little USB hubs, either black or white. Done in the Apple styling with the Apple logo, which would be lit up by an LED underneath it. Needless to say, they got a cease and desist slapped onto them pretty quickly. But before they did, I made sure that I had some evidence kept in a safe place in case it was ever required. And it looks good beside my other Macs anyway. But I digress. So, Paul.
Okay.
Broken?
Yeah. So I don't know if this... I'm not sure to what extent this will be interesting, but there is an auction for... It says Broken Novation AppleCat 2 Communications Cards. So this will actually just be an opportunity mainly to talk about the AppleCat. But so it includes two AppleCat 2 cards, which are... it's a modem card that worked in the Apple II. Basically a 300 baud modem. And so what's wrong with these is that there's a PLI, I forget what it stands for, but there's a box that goes on a non-broken one that actually makes the thing work. And there are two basic cards and one of the boxes. And I think there's a couple of chips that aren't working. So like the idea, I guess the question is whether you can take these two things and create a single AppleCat. But if you can, this isn't too expensive for that. It's shipping from Hawaii, but the AppleCat 2 is a really cool modem. I mean, it's actually, I'm not sure, do either of you know it?
I have no idea what it is.
Okay. No, it's, yeah, but as I said, I'm an Apple IIc guy, so I used to plug a modem into the port socket on the back because, as everyone knows, the Apple IIc has everything in it that you would ever need.
Right, like the Apple III.
Except for the boxes that hang off the back by cables.
Right. I mean, we live in a time when modems are kind of, you know, it's not really clear what good a modem is, because, I mean...
Yeah, working or otherwise.
Right. I mean, first of all, who has a landline anymore? But, So the Apple Cat 2 was you know an early-ish modem for the Novation was a modem company and they'd made a number of these things. There was an earlier coupler called I think the Novation Cat. The Apple Cat 2 was a modem that could do 300 baud modem communications. It sat in the Apple II, and one of the things that made it special was that it basically had a lot of extra stuff on it. So it had the capability of going 1200 baud, but half duplex. So it didn't do the regular Bell 212 1200 baud, but it did do Bell 202, which was able to go 1200 baud, but only in one direction. So this was very popular among the people who traded software across bulletin boards, because this is like four times the speed. What was kind of neat about it was that essentially you have to, if you're calling a board that has that's using this Apple Cat protocol, you can only type and get a response at 300 baud because that's full duplex. And so in order to kind of like jump back and forth between 300 and 1200, there were these little control codes it would send that says, you know, okay, I'm going to send fast now. When it's finished, it says, okay, now switch back to 300 so I can hear you. So there were the other thing, actually, this also had the ability to decode touch tones. It had the ability to, if you get a little extra box, you can run lights with an X10 system. It could do sound synthesis, so you could use it to, make all those multicolored boxes that people, you know, in the telephone freak community would use, or, you know, just regular touch tone. So it was really quite an interesting thing, and I'll stop here in a second, but it's among the modems that you can have. It seems like it's one of the modems that you could actually still do something interesting with, because it does have these sound generation capabilities and listening capabilities, and it would be neat to see one of these, you know, Apple Cat transfer programs running again. So, and you know, they're a little bit hard to come by, so at least here's a possible way that you could build one out of two broken ones. That's it.
A lot more cool. Interesting than I thought it was going to be. So thank you very much, Paul. Okay, so let's just have one last final wrap-up. So anything happening at your end of the world, Jack?
Oh, not too much. I have been adding a bit to my collection of Atari 8-bit games on cartridge, which is sort of the one thing that I'm allowing myself to collect a little bit these days, which is pretty fun. So I've been sort of spending too much time looking at eBay auctions for these things, and like I think that I figured out that kind of for most Atari 8-bit computer cartridge games, $5 or $6 is kind of it. Then there are a few oddball ones that will ramp up to cost dozens or even upwards of $100. And there was actually one really great auction that was like 35 cartridges. And I was thinking, okay, mathematically, yeah, $150 is pretty good. But I couldn't quite get myself to sort of push along with the auction and spend that amount of money for it. I kind of kicked myself afterwards for bowing out, but oh well. That's all I've got going on here in retro computing land.
Much more control than me.
So Paul, what have you been up to in a less controlled manner?
Well, I continue to try to get these stupid PCs running.
weren't you doing this about four shows ago? When I was last on, you must be having so much fun with PC drivers by now. You must write a book about it.
Oh man! Well, just to recap, what I'm trying to do is get a PC running, and get a Brunelli drive connected and running. I have just before we started recording, I finally got a hard drive connected, and I think I actually might be on the verge of having this work, but I can't believe how long it's been taking. So I've been doing that.
Well, maybe we should get back to you on what show 100 just to see how things are going.
next time I'll have something interesting to say. In the meantime, while I was sort of in the midst of that, I got an old VCR out and did some digitizing of some tapes that I had around. There was a particular videotape that I was trying to get off, but while I had the setup going, I had a couple of old tapes that I forget exactly. They came from some eBay auction at some point. They I think they all came from Computerland, some old Computerland store. There were a couple of videos that had, one was a, like three, they're all sort of marketing videos. One was three Apple videos kind of talking about the Mac in the business environment. This is the era of the Mac 2 and Mac SE. And there were, there was a Computerland ad, you know, that was featuring Macs and, you know, talking about how these two people can't decide between the SE and the 2, so they're going to get both. And then there was a video that that introduced the Computerland, I forget what it was called, like the Computerland business system or something like this, which was Computerland's own PC clone. And so it's like a, I think it's like a 8-minute video or something like that of you know, just sort of going over the aspects of this clone, which all sound, it seems very, they seem very unremarkable, although I guess it was sort of more modular than most. But anyway, so I digitized those and put them up, and I'll put a link somewhere to those just because it's good to have these things out there. I'm not actually sure that they were out there before. I think they might not have been. So.
Yeah, I used to digitize tapes. I used to use a Canopus ADVC-100, so I could just then hook up the feed into any video editing package as if it just got detected as just as another FireWire or whatever they wanted to call FireWire, depending on the package and the platform you're using, and catch it all in that way. But what I liked about it back then as well is that also allowed me to put out via S-Video or composite with audio. So this was back in the days when videotapes were still being used. So the family stuff that I was capturing and writing out to DVD, so I was also able to put back out to a VHS tape for some of the less technologically advanced members of the extended family at that stage. But I haven't used the ADVC for a while, but yeah, if I come across any old videotapes and things that aren't out on YouTube or others, then must remember that I've got that there, because a very good codec built in there. I found that it gave a better capture result than some camcorders, though some camcorders feeding in that analog signal did do quite a good job, but not the ones I had.
Yeah, I'm definitely... videotapes have fared less well than floppy disks, it seems. I mean,
oh yes,
it's some of these tapes are really quite noisy, and there are some interesting, you know, there's some nice, you know, video cleanup tools you can use. JES Video Cleaner is very good, I mean, it's time to do it now.
It is. Yeah. Don't wait. Even original tapes aren't as good as they were. You know, you're not remembering it better than it was. It was better than you're seeing it now.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You've got something on a beta or a VHS or Super 8, any formats. Actually, I'd even be, even if you got stuff on DV25s, I'd be getting that onto disc media because I just think that a lot of that earlier tape is problematic, not just the method of encoding it. So, yeah, I'm having to get around. I think I'll have to get all my rest of all my DV25 mini DV tapes up onto disc. Most of them are from just the editing process, but there are a couple which I've inherited which I should get around. But on other things, I've registered for to go to OzKFest next month, so I'll be flying down to Melbourne to go to Australia's own little Apple conference. That's going to be,
cool.
I believe, cool. Friday the 17th of April, and then the 18th and 19th for the weekend. And continuing in Apple mode, I'm currently waiting for registration for KFest. To open up, I believe that's going to take registrations next month. So, passport renewed and my flights over to Missouri booked for that. So,
so you're going to hit both?
Going to hit both, yeah. I can do that this year. In previous years, OzKFest was actually held over the same weekend that Kansas Fest spanned, and they used to try and get a video hookup between the two. But this year it was decided that we'd go for our own weekend, and I suppose that opened the opportunity for all those people who attend Kansas Fest in the US can hop on a plane and fly over and join us here in Australia.
Why not? Those flights do go both ways.
It does. It's bi-directional.
Full duplex, you might say.
How many people usually go to the OzK Fest? Is it about the same size as the American one?
I think we've got just under 20 registered, but normally there's a bit of a late last-minute registration. So, no, that's a pretty good gathering for a retro fair of for the population size we got. And, you know, even being held in Australia, that's still quite some large distances for people to fly or drive into to attend. So it's I think that it's going to be quite a good turn up. I think we had about 15 or so 2 years ago when we did OzK Fest up in Brisbane. So looking forward to it. Cool. So I'm going to do a couple of presentations and just enjoy catching up with everybody. We do a Friday night chat session, but it's always good to catch up with everybody over conference and a couple of dinners and whatnot, and come some barbecue lunches. So we'll just see how it goes. Okay, well, I think that's a wrap for this show. So thanks for joining me, gents. And everybody, you can find show notes for all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com, even way back to RCR episode 1. You can discuss us in the forums at vintagecomputer.com, in the Vintage Computer Forum. You can follow the newly invigorated RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. And you can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. So if you've got any news ideas or follow up on today's reminiscing of laser printing, we'd love to hear from you. We're also a member of the Throwback Network. And to help others find us on iTunes and to just improve the visibility of the RCR, please write us a review. So guys, until next time.
Retro Compute.